The economics of happiness is interesting, and to sort of know what contributes to human happiness is practical in our own lives.
So GDP is what we use to measure how economies are doing, but what about how we're doing?
When you turn to developing an index of national well-being, it's a little broader than that in some ways. And the main thing you're trying to do is to see how are we doing as a society and to be able to honestly grade governments. I'm Miles Kimball, and I'm an economist. I've been interested in many, many areas of research, but one of the most important is trying to develop the principles needed for a national well-being index.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In today's program, Measuring National Well-Being, something University of Colorado Boulder's Miles Kimball says GDP is not very good at.
Think of how GDP is used. So we think of a national well-being index as being something that would be ideally co-equal with GDP. GDP has a lot of important uses, but one of the uses that it is employed for, but it's not terribly well suited for, is just assessing a government, accountability for governments. Is this government doing a good job in making people's lives better? If you want to answer that question well, you want to have a very good measure of how people's lives are. And there are a lot of reasons why gross domestic product can be growing quite nicely and many, many people can be miserable.
So if GDP does not reflect our reality, what does it reflect?
Oh, no, it reflects an important aspect of reality. I mean, there's nothing wrong with GDP. It reflects how much we're producing. And historically, one of the important reasons for GDP was to see what resources there were available for war. And GDP is actually a good measure for that. And quite importantly, as a measure of capability for war, it's actually not GDP per capita, GDP per person that matters. It's total GDP, just how big is your economy? And that tells you how big a military you can support. And that matters for geopolitical competition. So that's one of the big things you definitely want GDP for. And a measure of national well-being cannot serve that purpose. A measure of national well-being doesn't tell you how many resources you have to support a military.
Yeah, it's an interesting aspect that we don't often think about, or at least often hear about. But getting back to sort of trying to measure well-being, you use in the article that you've written for Finance and Development magazine, you mention, you know, use an example of using per capita GDP as a yardstick, that Americans are, in fact, better off today than they were before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so what's missing in that picture? And what are you suggesting that might give us more context?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of things you could worry about. I mean, one of the big problems is we don't have regular data collection that tells us in a granular way how people are doing in lots of different areas. I mean, mental health problems have risen during the pandemic. There's certainly an important fraction of the population that really gets stressed out when they need to hole up at home. I think that's especially true for young people. Yeah. You know, you're kind of built to go out and spend time with friends. And if that isn't happening, that can be very depressing. And so, you know, it's a big problem. We don't do the data collection really systematically, but there are bits and pieces saying that the lockdowns and the shutdowns of schools have been really quite stressful for people. Mm-hmm. Not to mention those people who were unemployed for important periods because of the shutdown of parts of the hospitality sector. there you have a big effect on certain people. That's pretty heavy.
So capturing the more the emotional disruptions that were caused by this pandemic, what you're saying are not necessarily captured in what we're looking at in per capita GDP. So what are you suggesting that could capture these things better?
Well, so in a well-being index, you start out with questions that ask people directly about the things that they ultimately care about. So part of our viewpoint is that the things that you go and buy from the store or other buy in the market more generally are really inputs into what you do in your household and in your life. So you care about things like being happy and having a sense of meaning and purpose in your life and having love and feeling like you get respect. And so we try to focus in on measuring the ultimate things that people care about and viewing the things you would buy at the store as being a means to that end.
So what essentially we're trying to do here is place a value on things that we've not generally placed value on before, like, you know, one's relationship with nature, for example, that you talk about in your piece, freedom, essentially, and imagination, things like that, politics, and the way that you're proposing to do this is through an index.
Yeah. Well, you first ask people how they're doing on these different things, and then you got to combine them somehow.
Right. So how does the index work? I mean, you do place importance on the weighting process of, you know, trying to evaluate, you know, what information is important and what's not so important when you're trying to establish the well-being of people.
So
maybe just walk us through that process.
Right. So, you know, you're going to have... If you do this kind of a data collection, which is the foundation of any national well-being index, you're going to have all the details. So you can look at all the details. But as a practical matter, to have the kind of influence, the good influence on policymaking, you really do have to distill things down to a single number. Because otherwise, what's going to happen is, you know, whoever's in power is going to just point to the one thing that's going well and try to distract your attention from all the things that are going badly. Now, one of the great advantages of GDP is you can't do that. You know, you can't say, oh, this sector of the economy is doing great, so just don't pay attention to all those other pieces of the economy. No, there's a lot of salience. People are going to notice what's happening to GDP overall. And we want to have a national well-being index that has that same salience where the folks in power can't say, oh, we're doing well because of this or that thing over in that corner. But they're really forced to try to make this overall measure doing well. And so what you want is for it to be comprehensive in two different ways. You want to make sure that it's covering every aspect of life that people care about to the extent that's humanly possible.
Then
the second thing is you want to make sure it's comprehensive in terms of covering everybody's life.
Right.
And making sure that you're looking at lives and you want to count everybody's life equally. Rather than counting everybody's dollars equally, you want to count everybody's life equally. And you've got to decide how to balance things out, how to make an overall judgment of how the society is doing, how the country is doing, when some people got better off and some people got worse off. And so you need to make adjustments for, you know, inequality. And that's the adjustments for inequality is what measuring things in dollars does very badly. Even if you were willing to make the approximation that if people have a higher income, they're better off, you still have this question of, is an extra $1,000 a year worth the same to a billionaire as how much an extra $1,000 a year is worth to somebody who's living on just $10,000 a year total. So you need to adjust for that. And GDP figures are really miserable at doing that. They don't even try. And we want to make sure that the scientists like us who are designing the well-being index are not making the most fundamental judgments. There are some things that are scientific questions, and there are some things that are really should be the judgments of the people in general. What are the most important things? That should not be our judgment. That should be the judgment of the people in the nation.
But so answers to surveys like that, you know, it seems like it could be a pretty subjective process. How do you avoid, you know, it being politicized?
Well, I mean, actually, we think our approach has all the subjective judgments being made by the people. So you get a representative sample of people in the nation where the average of what's going on is very similar to what is happening to everybody. And you just make sure that all the subjective judgments are made by the people of the nation as represented by this representative sample of people answering the survey. The people managing the data collection shouldn't be making these subjective judgments. And one area where that really matters is sometimes folks who are very highly educated who become scientists often have different priorities than folks who are, let's say you have some blue collar folks. And there's one example that we've seen in our preliminary data is that it looks like folks who are very highly educated put a greater premium on life satisfaction than folks who are dealing with more nuts and bolts struggles in their life. And so I think it's dangerous to just, it can be distorting to just let experts decide what's important rather than really asking people what they think is important.
That goes to the point that you make in this article about the issue of weighting, you know, the importance of having the right process in place to sift through all this data.
Yeah, exactly. The experts should not be deciding what's important. We don't want to be approaching things in a way that has the priorities of very highly educated people with their elite lives and ignoring the priorities that people have who are, you know, like I gave the example of blue collar folks, and it really matters. I mean, part of the political divisions in the United States have to do with a lack of respect for people who have different priorities in their life. We need to understand one another and not be too dismissive of other people who see the world in a different way. I mean, and of course it's gotten so bad with the political polarization that other things have been very great high conflict and bad things happen. But I think if you go back 25 years, just basic interpersonal respect at a greater level could have done a lot to avert the kind of gradual progression of political polarization to get worse and worse and worse the way it has.
So you think that an effective well-being index might be a unifying force socially?
Well, I that's a little bit optimistic, but what it would have done is it lets you know when people are unhappy. I think some of the things that have happened to us politically have happened because there were people who are getting very, very unhappy, and the folks running the country didn't realize just how unhappy they were getting. And if you had this National Well-Being Index, and remember, once you get the data, you can look at it for the different subgroups. If we'd had this kind of data and it had this prominence in national affairs that we want a National Well-Being Index to have, people would have sat up and taken notice at the people who were very, very unhappy before it became this huge political rift. You would have had a lot more politicians kind of paying attention to those issues. I mean, when people feel like they're not being heard, they get angry. And that ends up having, you know, titanic political effects.
And just to conclude here, you mentioned this in your article as well. What gets measured gets treasured.
Yes.
And it's something that we hear in the well-being circles. But that applies to GDP as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the shortcomings of GDP are largely due to its narrow focus. And what you're talking about is an index based on answers to surveys. How do you make sure that you're hearing from all segments of society so that we're not like getting simply a broader picture of well-being, perhaps, but of the same lives that GDP is currently capturing?
Yeah. So I think that Ari Kaptein has pioneered the way to get the kinds of survey samples that you want. So he's done this with many surveys, and the survey that he leads now is the Understanding America study run out of USC, but they recruit people to do to be on a web panel, that is to answer a survey on a website regularly. And if somebody doesn't have internet access, they'll get them internet access and they will pay them enough for doing the survey to make it worth their while. I think getting a good survey sample is really important. I think that one interesting issue that I think is worth thinking about is including children.
Yeah.
You know, there are folks who are too young to vote because we don't think they can understand well enough issues of which candidate to vote for. But teenagers might well be able to tell you whether their life is good or not. Even if we don't trust them to judge which candidate to vote for, we might trust teenagers to tell us, is your life good or not? Or do you feel do you feel happy? Do you feel like your life is going well? And so I think that's one of the interesting questions. Can you do these surveys for folks who are, say, between the ages of 12 and 17? You know, I think as it is now, the surveys are mostly done for people 18 and up. I think there's another huge question, which is, do you limit things to citizens or do you include other people residing in the country?
Yeah.
And the sort of whether you count the well-being of non-citizens or not, I think is one of the most contentious political issues there is these days. But that's certainly an important question you have to answer one way or another.
It's so interesting. Miles Kimball, professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, thanks so much for sharing your research on a well-being index.
Thank you.
Miles Kimball is co-author, along with Daniel Benjamin, Kristen Cooper, and Ori Heffetz, of a feature article on measuring national well-being published in the December issue of Finance and Development magazine. Check it out at imf.org/FND or download the Finance and Development app. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.